Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsible day for the 10th of Tammuz. Today we're going to learn from the Tetz Eliezer in volume 15, response number 10, about the question of burying Kitvei HaKodesh and some related issues. Let's start with thanking the OU and Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz and David Hochhauser for helping us make these shiurim available to you. And then we'll plunge right in. And this is a response that's dated the 10th of Tammuz of Tuf Shin Mem Aleph of 1981. So the Tetz Eliezer opens up by pointing out that this is the third letter he's writing to the fellow that he's writing to. So he mentions it a couple of times. It seems to me that he was getting a little tired of the back and forth. You know, he was saying something, and the guy kept saying, well, what about this? And he kept answering, and he answered, and the guy said, what about this? In any case, it's interesting to watch those sort of dynamics between among Torah scholars and those who come to them. Interestingly, as far as I could tell, one of the earlier responses on this issue actually ended up being published in this volume and starting in Tav Vav Chet. Right, this is Yud, so Chet and then Tet Yud are the correspondence you have on Torah. It starts with a Sefer Torah Shibala, with a Sefer Torah that got used up in some way or got eaten up or, you know, worn away. So the halacha generally is gonzin, that we put it away. You know, some people will bury it, and we'll talk about that later in this responsive too, about the process of burying it, but you put it away. You don't just dispose of it. You put it away and you eventually bury it. You treat it as something of kadosh. So that's a question about how we deal with these things. And then he's got some other related questions. He has a list at the beginning, but we'll just look into it and we'll see where we get to. So the beginning of the letter the man had written to him, which was his third letter to the Tetz Eliezer on this issue, he pointed out that the Shulchan Aruch does talk about the question of making tachrichin out of mitpichot sefer Torah shebalo. So mitpichot, or mitpachat, is like a napkin or a cloth or some kind of a thing that wraps around or covers up a sefer Torah, or is a decoration of a sefer Torah that works for the sefer Torah to cover it. So let's say if you had a sefer Torah cover and it got worn out, you couldn't use it as a sefer Torah cover anymore. So in Orech Chaim, the Shulchan Aruch writes that they got worn out some way, they're no longer usable, and he writes that, and then afterwards he writes that a Sefer Torah Shabala. What do you do about a Sefer Torah itself? So that would sound like you talk first about the mitpachot, the coverings, and the Sefer Torah itself, but in Yerideya, it's the reverse. Not only that, in Or HaChaim, when the Shulchan Aruch deals with it, he wrote mitpichot sefer Torah, the coverings for sefer Torah, whereas in Yerideya, when he gets up talking about it, he writes mitpichot sefarim, the covers for sefarim, which could also include sefarim of Nach. Let's remember that while, and there are shuls today that still do it, but there was a time when you read even Nach, it would be out of parchment, a scroll where the Nach was written, like we write our Sefer Torah, the Nach would be written on it that way as well. There are places where you read the Sefer, the Haftarah, out of a scroll like that, and the Baal Kore, the man who reads it, has to know how to read that by heart as well, so that it would up the challenge for being able to get, you know, Maftir, if you're going to be one of those people who read it from the thing itself, or you need a Baal Kore for that as well. So why did the Yerideya talk about mitpichot sfarim in general, the coverings for sfarim in general, and in Or HaChaim, spoke about the Sefer Torah? In Or HaChaim as well, another difference the minister pointed out, the Shulchan Aruch writes that you're allowed, yecholim la'asot mehem tachrichin mitzvah, you are allowed to make tachrichin. So tachrichin is a shroud, it's the garments that a deceased person has worn. So that's why the mitpachot, the coverings we make today, usually don't work well as tachrichin. So I think the mitpachot, either in their times, they made mitpachot, they made the coverings for Sefer Torah out of the exact same things that we make tachrichin out of. I think we make tachrichin out of like a light, simple cotton, I think, or linen, but something like that. And the coverings that we use for Sefer Torah are not like that usually, but that's what Shulchan Aruch said. You could use them for a mate mitzvah, whereas it sounds like you don't have to, just you can. Whereas in Yerideya, he writes, osin, you make it, and it sounds like it's an obligation. So this man who's writing to Eliezer suggested, there is this common locution in learning, in the circles of Torah learning, you'll say, he wanted to suggest, and I fully understand what they mean. Wanted to suggest means that you have an idea and you think it's a good idea, so you offer the idea. But want to suggest isn't actually English. In fact, once you want to suggest something and you say it out loud, you are suggesting it. So Here, the phrase in the Hebrew is, V'lachein rotzeh lechalek. He wants to differentiate. What that means is, he's differentiating that way. When he says he wants to, it means he wants to assume that that's a correct differentiation. So, his suggested differentiation is, Shedavka b'chotz farim shekidushan mu'etet kovalas. If you have coverings for books of Nach, so they have a lower level of Kedusha because the writings in Nevi'im and Ketuvim and the prophets and the hagiographa are of a lower level of sanctity, whereas they're assumed to be of a lower level also of prophetic inspiration than the Torah itself. So therefore, the things, the items that are used, the materials that are used as coverings for that, when they get worn out, since they have a lower level of sanctity, we might have thought it's an obligation to make them tachrich lemet, to use them as shrouds for a meit mitzvah, for somebody who's passed. We're going to get back to that phrase, meit mitzvah, in a few minutes. But coverings for Sefer Torah, where they have a higher level of sanctity, you might have thought you're not required to use them as tachrich. Meaning, there's, I think the implication that this man is suggesting is that there's some not denigration or lowering of sanctity, but we're using it for a purpose that's not its original purpose, and that has to do with the deceased, which isn't always so pleasant. So you might have thought that if you have an item of the sanctity level of Svarim, if you have an item of the sanctity level of Svarim, of regular books of Tanakh, so then once they're worn out, then they can't be used for their original purpose, and just burying them on their own isn't such a great thing. So yes, you should use them for some other positive value purpose. But when it's the coverings for a Sefer Torah, for a Torah scroll itself, that would be of such a high sanctity, you wouldn't say it that. So the Ezra says, it's really a very good insight, he says, but hold on. That's not the end of the story. And he says to him, and I'll tell you that Sefer Torah Chaim, he already came upon, he already noticed that difference in language between the two places where the Shulchan Aruch deals with this question, and he offered a similar suggestion. So right in there already, there's a bit of a, I'm not sure it's a reprimand, but it's, you haven't done as much research as you think you've done. It's a reminder that there have been others who have come before him who have had good ideas too. And that's to me, somebody who knows very, very little, a lingering problem, how much research one is required to do before knowing something, before ruling on something, before suggesting a new idea, right? You know, if anybody ever can suggest a new idea, when Rav Yosef was alive, they would run the risk of him saying, oh yeah, you know, in shit so-and-so, that somewhere off in a library somewhere that I happened to find, he had a similar idea. So that becomes quite a challenge. Although it may be that I'm reading too much. Now, I do think it's true that Sefer Torah Chaim, depending which one that is, there is a Torah Chaim, I think, which was a relatively well-known Sefer, a relatively well-known Acharon, and therefore there might have been a little bit of it in that. Yes. So the question of what we're supposed to know or required to know and what is sort of embarrassing to find out that we didn't know, I think that's a question that comes up a lot. And the answer was from a camp that certainly stressed wide-ranging knowledge, whereas there are other great Torah scholars who had great knowledge but not wide-ranging knowledge. Meaning, if I tell you that somebody knows all of Shas, Bavli, and Yerushalmi, and Rambam, and Shulchan Aruch, with all of their Nosei Kelim, with all of their commentators that are printed in the books, let's say I knew somebody who was just like that and was a posek, that would be a lot, right? And they knew Tur and Beis Yosef as well. That would be a lot, but that's not what I mean by wide-ranging knowledge. In the world of halachic decisors, that's not considered a lot. So, so you have to keep that in mind. Anyway, so he says, great idea, interesting idea, cool idea, well thought out, ulam. However, l'halacha in lazuz mipirushon shel Beit Yosef ataz v'shach. But unfortunately, when you look at the Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Yosef on the Tur, who eventually wrote the Shulchan Aruch, and the Taz and the Shach on the Shulchan Aruch, don't agree. It's always a rishut. They don't read that passage in Yeredeya, which says where the way the words are written is when it comes to mipachot svarim, you know, that you do it, that you use them as, which this man had inferred meant you're obligated to. They said they didn't have any understanding that way. It was all a question of reshut, a question of if you wanted to, you could. And they also saw no distinction between other books of Tanakh and a Sefer Torah. So in other words, good idea. Unfortunately for you, the people who came before you, who are the giants of reading Shulchan Aruch, say no. That's a nice, interesting comment to think about, where we do and don't do that, where do we allow ourselves novel ideas, where we don't, where do we say, well, even though they said it, I say this. But in this case, Sili Ezra is taking for granted, and I'm not disagreeing, but Sili Ezra is taking for granted And if the Shulchan Aruch wrote it one way, and Beis Yosef makes it clear that that's the way he understood it, and the Shachar V'Taz makes sure that clear that they understood it that way as well, there's nothing here, just on the basis of an inference and the change of language between the two places, that's going to be nearly good enough to assert a new obligation to use as tachrichim worn-out coverings for other books of Nevi'im, of other books of Tanakh, right? Books of Nevi'im and Ketuvim. Where he does agree with it, however, is the man has suggested that when the Shulchan Aruch says you can use them as tachrichim, we can use them as burial shrouds, lemeit mitzvah, for a meit mitzvah. So meit mitzvah in many halachic contexts has a very specific meaning. A meit mitzvah in other halachic contexts is somebody who has passed away and there's nobody around to bury him. The common way that it was said, the way it was explained to me, you know, when I was learning it for the first time, was you're walking on the road and you discover somebody who has been killed, a Jew who has been killed or passed away, and there's nobody around to bury them, and there's no place to go so easily to find and to bury that person. So that's a halachic obligation upon that Jew to bury him, and there are all sorts of halachot about that meit mitzvah then acquires immediately the land in which he's buried. The halachos about even a kohen gadol who encounters a meit mitzvah would have to bury that meit mitzvah. So if you said that when the Shulchan Aruch says you could use those burial shrouds, those worn out coverings as burial shrouds, if it was only for a meit mitzvah that you could use, that would be a very restricted occasion, because we hope and thank God there aren't that many meitei mitzvah. Usually, when people pass away, there's a family involved, there's a local community, there's a chavar kedisha, there's all sorts of institutions in place that can cover these situations. And therefore, it would seem like you don't have a lot of meitei mitzvah. But this man said, I don't think meitei mitzvah here means meitei mitzvah. I think meitei mitzvah means a meit where there's a mitzvah to bury him in any way whatsoever. So, for example, and the phrase meitei mitzvah, he says, Hashem Mishal, it's just using the phrase because we're so used to it. But it really means anybody whose burial needs are going to be put on the community. So, for example, let's say you have somebody who's poor, right, and doesn't have heirs, right, who are going to pay for the funeral. Or let's say just the family doesn't have the costs of a funeral, and therefore the community is going to help as the community should. That's all good. This man is saying, and Tzitzis is about to agree with him, that would fit the context of what the Shulchan Aruch meant. The Shulchan Aruch didn't mean meit mitzvah as in a meit, that specific narrow example of a meit who passed away in a place where there's absolutely nobody around to bury him, and the Jew finds him or her has to bury him or her, right? That's too restrictive. It's any time there's a meit, there's somebody who's passed away whose needs for burial are going to be the responsibility of the community, there you could use these worn out Torah coverings as material for the shrouds. And then the Tzitzis writes, the Aruch HaShulchan writes that explicitly. The meit mitzvah here is the means anybody who doesn't have the ability to pay for their own funeral costs, who we're going to cover, right? Who's the person we're going to cover? There's a whole subtext here that I don't want to get into because people don't like hearing about it today. But in your day, it talks about an adam kasha, that it means somebody who is worthy of it. The definition of worthy is very tense. So nowadays, pretty much, I think communities don't make a lot of distinction in these areas. So if it would be anybody who the community would feel obligated to be involved in their burial, they could use these kinds of coverings for it. The Aruch HaShulchan actually added then that meit mitzvah doesn't mean a meit mitzvah. It actually means any dead person. And the truth is that you could use any dead person. So let's say, for example, there's a very wealthy person who decided they prefer to be buried in these shrouds because they think it's like a big honor to use those shrouds, and they're going to give a big donation to the community for it. You could do that. So why does it refer to as a meit? So the Aruch HaShulchan suggested that was to tell you that you should put these aniyim first, the people who are impoverished and don't have their burial needs. They should go first in line for getting these shrouds for them. And there was a statement of Menachem Meshed Nefesh that it said the same thing. So if that's what it means, and it's not true that there's an difference between the mitpechot, the coverings of a Sefer Torah and the coverings of other books of Nach, then why was it put first in Or HaChaim and the other one was put first in Yerideah? So Zeza says that he thinks it's very simple. If you just read it there, it was in the context, in the flow of the context there. It's in Or HaChaim, he was talking first about what you're going to have to bury because it's worn out, or what you, right, or what you can use, even though they're going to get worn out, what you can do with them. So he started with the things that were lighter and more easily understood, and then he moved to the other things. Whereas in Yoreh Day, he was talking first about the Sefer Torah and all the items that have to do with serving the Sefer Torah, and that's why he put the Sefer Torah in first, and whatever. So in other words, the Sicilians are things that in that situation, Sometimes the easiest answer is the most correct answer, and which is the context question. And the way the Shulchan Aruch wrote it was, in the context, it fit better that way. Once we're talking about a Sefer Torah, since the Eliezer says, we're talking about a Sefer Torah that's gotten worn out, there's another halacha that didn't come up in this man's letter to him, but that once he's got there, he wants to mention, he thinks it's an interesting idea, and he's quoting it from Rav Chenech Agus of Vilna, who lived in Vilna before World War II, and he wrote a sefer called Mar Cheshet, that I think that real Torah scholars think of as a very valuable sefer, and that they used and admired. So Rav Chenech Agus pointed out there was a custom to bury a sefer Torah when the sefer Torah got worn out. You had to bury it. You would bury it near a Torah scholar. So some people thought the halacha is you have to bury it near a Torah scholar. So the Rav Chenech Agus says, no, he thinks it's a function of another halacha that's well-known as well. There's a halacha that's well-known that we've spoken about in a couple of circumstances already. I remember Rav Moshe Feinstein at Tshuva about the person who was taken out of Russia, and the family had cremated him for whatever reasons, and then there was a whole question about where they could be buried. So one of the things is, it says there you can't bury non-observant people or rishaim, evildoers, near tzaddikim, near those who try to keep the Torah well. And that halacha is inferred from the fact that the Gemara makes it very clear that in times of the Beit Din of a court, when a court still applied capital punishment, they wouldn't put to death, they wouldn't bury those who were put to death with a higher form of a chiyuv mita, of a punishment of death, near those who were buried with a lower form, who had been killed with a lower form. So those who got skila and shreifa, the two worst versions of capital punishment, would have to be buried separate from those who got cherev vechenek, who got killed by the sword or by strangulation, because those were lower-level evildoers. So there we get this idea, and this is a very complicated idea to apply in practice. I'm not saying exactly how it works today, but you don't bury a Rosh Eltel Tzaddik. So therefore, Rav Chenech Agus said, Sefer Torah is like a tzaddik. Sefer Torah has never done anything wrong. So Sefer Torah would be like a tzaddik. So if you bury a Sefer Torah near ordinary people, it would be some kind of a gnai. It would be like a denigration of the Sefer Torah. And that's why we say you should bury it near a Torah scholar. The reason why that's valuable to know is because then it doesn't mean that there's an halacha that has to be buried near a Torah scholar. Let's say I found an open area where there's nobody buried. I could bury a Sefer Torah there. It's not that it has to be buried near a Sefer Torah, near a Torah scholar or a tzaddik or a righteous person. It has to be buried either near a Torah scholar or not near. Really, basically, it's a negative halacha. You can't bury them near people who aren't righteous and good. And since there's things that the distance that there has to be between the Torah, it's a scroll. Now, he's not talking about this, but it would also mean between a righteous person and a non-righteous person. So he thinks between a Torah scroll and an average, he calls him an ish hamoni ve'am ha'aretz, between a, I think that might be Rav Chenech Agus, actually. Rav Chenech Agus said, the distance should be 4 amot. The difference should be 4 amot, which is about 6 feet, between the Torah scholar, the Torah scroll he's talking about, but it would apply to a Torah scholar and a righteous person, should be about 4 amot, about 6 feet, or at least 4 amot from there to an ish hamoni. An ish hamoni is a lot different than amar. So amar is used as a derogatory comment about those who don't know anything and therefore don't really keep anything. That's the way that amar is used on halachic time. But ish hamoni is just a regular person. So what the regular people in Vilna were like halachically, I don't know. But the question that if we're going to follow that today, it would mean we would have real questions about where we would bury certain people near certain other people. We have to make evaluations that a lot of people today are uncomfortable with making. So I find that always an interesting thing to remember and to remind ourselves to think about in those contexts. And so that fills out, he says, that 4 amot standard is a standard he didn't know, because there's a Mabusha Yom Tov he had known and spoken about in other occasions where on every side of a Sefer Torah, you can't have other kinds of people, simple, plain people who are not so observant. And so we didn't know, he says, I didn't know what the distance was, but I see in this Merkashet, he thinks it's 4 amos. Now, 4 amos is a reasonable standard because, not the Merkashet, this is me talking, but so if you want to email me about it, it's grothst@gmail.com. But 4 amos is generally the standard for when we think there's a new space in halacha. So if you have that within the 4 amot of the Sefer Torah, there's nothing problematic for it, then in its space, there's no problem, there's no burial of something that would be seen as derogatory to it. Now, the man has suggested that you don't have to bury the Sefer Torah if you don't want to, even if it's worn out such that you can't use it. You can leave it in the Aron, if there's room in the Aron, with the kosher Torah scrolls. All you have to do is make sure that people know that it's a non-kosher one. So the common way to do this is that the gartel, or the vimple, the thing that we put when you if you've ever seen a Torah scroll, an Ashkenazi Torah scroll, when you wind it together, you put like a belt around it to hold it together, and then you put the covering on it. So in Torah scrolls, if for whatever reason they become puzzled, whether they can get fixed or not fixed, but you put that belt, you'll put it on the outside and everybody will see it, and that's the symbol, that's the well-known understandable symbol that it's not allowed to be used. So he writes that he thinks you're allowed to leave it there, and his proof is that you have, the tradition is that in the Aron, you had the Luchot, you had the tablets that Moshe brought, the second tablets, and you also had Shivrei Luchot. You also had the first tablets, the broken ones, they were there. So it shows that Shivrei Luchot, even broken tablets, can be there. So this says, yeah, that's right. And the Noda Behud already said it, the Binyan Sion already said it, and he quotes some other books of response of this said. And he says, and I wrote about it in my original Kutris. Apparently, this whole discussion started with a short book or a long essay that the Steelers had written on the topic. And go read it, and you'll find it there, which is, to me, always a sharp rebuke. Because, see, you're coming at me on issues now. Sometimes that rebuke is a hard one, meaning sometimes the Steelers will say, you know, I already wrote about this in volume 2 and whatever. And that would be a question of, before I can ask the Steelers a question, do I need to have read all of the volumes of his works? But here it seems like they were having a correspondence about this Kuntres itself. And this is the man's third response. He had written the man now three. This man has written to Caesar three times about this. Caesar responded the third time. So there I would think he would have read the original Kuntres, but apparently not. Now, he also points out that Noda Behuda, in the response on the discuss that issue, said that as long, this is based on the Gemara in, I think, Shabbos, as long as a Sefer Torah has 85 letters left to it, it still has its full sanctity. It's now a Sefer Torah Shebala. It's not its full sanctity. It's got the sanctity of a Sefer Torah Shebala. It's just that it got worn out. If it has fewer than 85 letters to it, if it's gotten so worn out or moth-eaten or ratted, whatever has happened to it, or burnt, God forbid, there's not even 85 letters, so then it's nothing. It's not a Sefer Torah anymore. And then, presumably, you wouldn't be leaving it in the Aron Kodesh anymore. But as long as it has 85 letters in it, so even if it, what happened was, however it happened, it got scratched out, or there were, or some acid fell on it, such that all the letters, you know, were wiped off, were rubbed off, were erased, except for 85 of them. And those 85 don't have to be all together, I don't think. Or maybe they do. 85 letters. Then it would still be kosher and be allowed to be left in the Aron with all the others. And then he quotes from a Shut Maharap, for that the Beis Din of Kolov said, you know, my whole life I've never seen the burial of Sefer Torah, because why do you bury Sefer Torah? You leave it in the Aron, and then Simchas Torah, you take it out and you dance with it, and you just do it. So why do you have to bury it? So sometimes I think, sometimes you don't have room for them anymore, and then you'll bury them. But he was saying that he thinks it should be an infrequent event to bury a Sefer Torah. So what do you do when you're going to bury a Sefer Torah? So Ritzidir says, I pointed out that the Gesher HaChaim, which is a work from the early 20th century about avelus issues, about mourning issues, and the man writing the letter to him had also mentioned the Gesher HaChaim. They used to have, you have like a procession, but you'd have not like so filled with sadness. The Sephardi custom in Yerushalayim was to do with tupim and mechulot, with like drums and other musical accompaniment, whereas in other places, you'd have special places for, you wouldn't do it in the regular cemetery, you'd have a special place for the burial of Sifrei Torah, Torah scrolls, of tefillin, of mezuzot that got worn out, right, of Sifrei Kodesh. The common custom has always been that even printed Sfarim, printed Torah books, are, that have gotten worn out, you don't throw them out, you bury them as well. So that was the custom. And he points out here that the common psak has always been that it's not only Torah books that are written on cloth, on parchment, like Torah scrolls, that need to be buried. That's why you have genizos, right? One of the famous genizos was one in Cairo, where people were just for centuries would put anything of Jewish writing basically into the Geniz, and you had all this stuff that eventually became this treasure trove of understanding the history of the Jewish people in all sorts of ways. And there are plenty of historians who still use that Geniz for lots and lots of things. There's still finding new stuff all the time of value in the Geniz. So the fact that it's printed, so that was all handwritten, or much of it was handwritten, but the psak is that even printed stuff you don't throw away, you have to bury it and not burn it. So that's a hard set of questions in a time when the amount of materials being produced has enormously grown, whether that's still true, but that's not our topic today. Then I just want to point out there's a comment here that where the guy had seemed to say, you know, I think there's a printing error in the Prima Gaudium, and the Titulus says, no, you have no basis for saying that, and we don't make up printer's mistakes just like that. That's a comment that I think bears following up as to when we do and don't feel comfortable about saying, oh, that must be a printer's mistake. Now, this last letter apparently had been written on the 27th of Sivan, meaning not the one that we're doing. We're doing the 10th of Tammuz one. But he had written to him on the 27th of Sivan, right? And he, since he was talking about the 27th of Sivan, tradition was that was the day when the Gemara tells a story about Rabbi Chanina ben Tradyon and his Sefer Torah being burned. So that was the day of it. So when you see a Sefer Torah burned, it's the day when people are supposed to fast out of sadness over the destruction of a Sefer Torah. So the man writing to the Tzitzit Ezra said, if an individual is fasting and he's in shul for mincha, so usually when we're fasting a public fast day, we say sim shalom at mincha rather than shalom rav, right? There's two versions of the Ashkenazic Shmoneh Esrei in terms of that last blessing of Shmoneh Esrei. Ashkenazim say sim shalom in the morning, they say shalom rav in the afternoon. I believe the Tzfarim say sim shalom even in the afternoon for mincha. But in the Ashkenazic custom, so you're at mincha, you're fasting, and the community is apparently not fasting, so what do you do? So the Mishnah Berurah, he quotes the Mishnah Berurah saying, Yakin Amitaneh Omer Shalom Rav. That an individual is fasting says Shalom Rav, even though he's fasting, the community is not. Therefore, he says Shalom Rav. So he says he thinks that's only when the Mishnah Berurah says he has to say Shalom Rav with the community, it's when the community is not fasting and he is fasting, right? It's about that he has a private fast. But if it was a public fast day, for some reason there was a community, let's say there was a bunch of old men in the community who were not healthy enough to fast, therefore they're not going to say Shim Shalom because they weren't fasting. So there, I think there's room to say that no, he would say Shim Shalom because it's a public fast day. But in a day when it's his own private fast and he's out in the community, then he would say Shalom Rav, I think is what he means. And then he adds as a postscript to the responsum that there are different customs about accompanying a Sefer Torah. And so he had said that in Sfarim and Yerushalayim you use drums and musical instruments, but he quoted a Sefer HaMatamim which said that when they bury Sefer Torah or other Torah books, they have a big community go, Chamon Chogeg, and they go to the cemetery, and they bury it in the ground, and they make an ohel. They make a kind of a marker. Now, an ohel doesn't have to mean a tent or a covering like that, but they make a marker so that everybody should know that this is a place where there's sanctified materials that have been buried. That would be in terms of, you know, burying people nearby, as we said before. And then the custom would be you'd have the Rav give a drasha there of some sort. He would give some kind of a Torah talk. And also, you do it at the time, and you often, this was the custom in the Sefer Matamim, you'd wait to bury this stuff until a time of plague, God forbid, because burying the Sefer Torah, burying the Torah's books and scrolls and stuff like that, and those materials, was considered a way to arouse Hashem's compassion. What would that be? Just like when we see sanctified materials, sanctified writing materials, especially what we call shemot. We call it shemot because they have shemot Hashem, they have the names of Hashem in them, and that's one of the standards for how you know what the material you have to bury. So if we are careful to bury shemos, we're careful to treat them right and well, and other matters of sanctity, and we don't want them just to be treated badly, we hope and can pray from that Hashem will have compassion on us and treat us the way as well, because we are partners in bringing the name of Hashem into the world. That's what the Sefer HaMatamim had written, and that was the way that custom developed. This really points out that this takes for granted that it's all Kitfei Kodesh, all holy writings that are buried, even printed ones, which we've said before, but that he wanted to stress, I think, because he knew people who didn't take it that way. Second, that you put them in a special place. It doesn't have to be right next to a Talmud Chacham, as we said before, in the name of the Marakeshes. This, too, takes that for granted. And third, you make a sign so that you can know, as he had said in his original kutras, as he had suggested, to make sure you know where they were buried. Now, once you do that, though, if you put them all in a special place and you put a sign on it, so then there's room to say that once that's done, you can bury people closer to there because you know that you're not going to mix them up. And also because it's such a separate place, that might mean that, let's say, you have somebody who's not any particularly great Jew, but you're going to bury them, you know, 2 amot away instead of 4 amot away. It might be that then it's okay because they have their own place. So that place has been designated with an ohel. So that ohel would have to be some kind of a real marker. But once it's set off from everybody else, that might be good enough to allow for those barrels. So those are some issues that the Tzitzit Ezra raised in the responding for the third time based on a kutras he'd originally written that we didn't have time to see together today. Some issues that he raised about the burial of Kitfei HaKodesh, of Torah scrolls, of the coverings of Torah scrolls, of other Torah books of Torah learning, And this is a discussion from the 10th of Tammuz of Tovshin Mem Aleph from 1981. With thanks again to Rabbi Jacob Rauman, David Hachazer, and the OU, I bid you a good day.